This is an interview with G.H. Hayes on Thursday, February 24th at his home in Victoria, B.C.
I thought I'd start asking you a bit about your life before the Navy and how things were like then.
Mm-hmm.
So feel free to take
Well, I was born in Winnipeg. And my father died before I was born. I had an older brother and a hard-working mother. And I trickled my way up through the normal school system to grade 11. And then I was very fortunate the year I graduated from grade 11, instead of going to work at Safeway store delivering groceries or something, I was given the opportunity to go over to England to a training ship, which trained people for officers in the merchant service, in the British merchant service, and called HMS Conway.
Right. So, sorry to interrupt. So, when you ended up doing that, was there anything that drove you to join on that ship?
Well, I wanted to travel, and this is the depths of the Depression.
Right.
You know, we're talking 1933 and 34.
Right.
And the Depression was still on in Canada. It was beginning to get a little better in Britain, I gather. But I got this opportunity to go and do what I really wanted to do. I had no expectation that I could do anything very much in Canada, because, as I say, nobody had any money to send me to university or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And it was long before there was many sort of scholarships and bursaries and stuff. And anyway, I wasn't that bright, come on. So, yes, I wanted to travel, and I reckoned that the only way I could travel was to work my way around, you know.
Right.
And that made the British Merchant Service ideal for doing what I thought I wanted to do.
Okay, well, let's continue with the Merchant Service then.
Well, I finished the 2 years in Conway. I was lucky enough to get the King's Gold Medal the year I left, which is a sort of the outstanding award of for the ship. And I went to sea in a small British cargo line called Silver Line, which is based in London, England. Never went back, the ships never went to England. They were all based on the east coast of the US. And starting at Halifax, you'd work down the east coast of North America, round the Gulf of Mexico, and then go across to South Africa and up the east coast of South Africa.
Right, so around the bottom there.
Yeah, and over to India, and out to Singapore, and then turn around and load cargo for the States or for Canada, and do a non-stop trip back from Singapore to Halifax and one, no stops.
Right.
And the ship only did 8 knots, so it took a hell of a long time.
Yeah, that is a while.
Yeah, we kept breaking down.
Yeah.
And I was doing that when the war came, and I had a commission in the Royal Naval Reserve as a midshipman at that point.
Okay.
Hadn't done any training in the Navy. But when the war came along, as soon as my ship got back to England, having said the ships never went back to England, obviously when the war came, it changed everything. And our first voyage back from the Far East was to Birkenhead, Liverpool.
Right. So would you say, were there any other reasons you ended up joining the Navy, or...?
No, I didn't think very much about, you know, it was considered quite an honor to be offered this. Actually, they were not technically commissions. They were warrants for a commission, but that's a technicality. But I didn't really think of it in terms of really ever going to war. It was just I was honored to be asked.
Right.
So I accepted it.
Okay. So once you've once you've joined up, what kind of training did you receive?
None. I was in it. The ship landed in Birkenhead, which is across the river from Liverpool. I was terribly impressed because there was a man standing on the jetty with a telegram in his hand for me. Of all the hundreds of thousands of British ships around the world, they knew where I was and where the ship was. And it told me I was called out, mobilized in the Royal Navy, and I was to go home and report my home address. So I looked up the girlfriend that I used to know, and went and stayed with her family for 10 days and got some uniforms and was sent to my first ship. It was promptly sunk at Dunkirk about 6 weeks later.
Okay. So what happened next then for you?
Yeah, I should explain that in the normal course of events, you would go in the merchant service, serve your apprenticeship, write your first certificate of competency called a second mate's ticket, and then go into the Navy and do 6 months or so and get some basic training in the Navy, and then go back to the merchant service. But as I say, the war came along and the whole thing got changed. They just needed people on board ships, and since I could navigate, because that's what I learned to do in Conway, I was reasonably useful, I assume, with no training at all from the Navy. I think it was intended eventually that I'd get some.
Mm-hmm.
But that's... Well, I joined the first ship. It was a little commandeered. It was a ferry boat that they commandeered that ran from, in peacetime, ran from England to the Isle of Man on the west coast of England. And because it was a little day ferry, it was pretty fast. It was 20 knots or so, which is pretty fast in those days. And of course, ideal. So when Dunkirk came along and there was a whole bunch of people that needed to get out of off the continent, we were ideal kind of ship to send over, because we could load quickly and run across the channel quickly and so on. We did one trip and got sunk the second trip.
Right.
And then I was sent home on a couple of weeks survivor's leave. And off to another appointment after that.
Right. So where were you next after Dunkirk?
After Dunkirk, I was a boarding officer based in Falmouth in Cornwall, which is part of the Naval Control of Shipping set up. Everything that moved in a ship was controlled one way or the other by the movement people. And I was a boarding officer there. But that only lasted about a month. And then I was sent to an outfit called the Mobile Balloon Barrage. Sounds terrific. Remember seeing pictures of those big balloons that they flew over London?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the story had it that Winston Churchill had this bright idea that why don't we tow them around convoys? They were designed to keep the bombing airplanes up high, you know, making them a little less accurate. So they tried. They put a couple of. They put a little Ford, the chassis of a Ford truck, on board the ship with a big winch and a hell of a lot of wire. And a bunch of Air Force guys came down and inflated a balloon and hooked it up to the wire, and off we went. There were eight of us. And we got shelled from Cape Greenock, because by this time the Germans had taken most of France. You know, France had fallen.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got bombed by day and shelled by night very often.
All right.
It was harrowing, to say the least.
Yeah. Okay. I'd like to move on to your time in the Atlantic, if we could do that.
Yeah, well, I went from there to the I transferred to the Canadian Navy,
mm-hmm.
or Canadian Naval Reserve, after a year or so in the Channel.
Right.
And was sent to a corvette immediately.
What was the name of that one?
That was the Trillium. She was one of the first 10 corvettes built in Canada. She was built for the British. And the deal was that she was built in Canada, Montreal, I think, my particular ship. And the deal was that the Canadian Navy would take her over to Britain and turn her over. And she'd be HMS. Well, when we got her over there, the British had weren't any more flush with men and trained people than we were. So they asked us to take. Canada had lots of people being trained, and no ships, of course,
mm-hmm.
or very few. Very small navy, you know, we had a dozen ships or so. And so they asked us to the Canadian Navy to man these first 10 corvettes.
Right.
Which we did.
Right.
And I joined about 4 or 5 months after they got over there.
Okay. So once you're aboard the corvette now, I'm assuming, but please correct me if I'm wrong. So you didn't get any new training once you were transferred.
No, I didn't get any training.
Yeah,
at all.
Again.
Just
okay.
Learned on the job.
On-site training.
On-site training. Yeah.
Right.
And it didn't bother me either. It's what's surprising.
Mm-hmm.
Many years later, it did, but.
How about the rest of the guys? Did they seem to be affected, or?
Well, everybody most of the crew, of course, had come immediately from Canada, and they'd been through the normal or the sort of the recruiting setup. You know, they'd gone down to the local recruiting office, been picked up. Some of them were professionals on the lakes and so on, but most of them were sent off to a 3 months training somewhere,
mm-hmm.
depending on whether they were all officers or men. And then there was a string, you know, going through of recruitment, basic training, some technical training on the side, and then to ships as they were commissioned, you know, as they were finished building.
Right. Okay. So once you're on board, tell me what happened first, I guess.
Well, I was made the navigator, which was fairly obvious, because
mm-hmm.
the ship that I joined had, the day I joined her, the first lieutenant, the second in command, was being carried ashore in a stretcher. He was sick, landed ashore, and there was the captain, the new first lieutenant who had joined the Navy in Ottawa about something like a year before, had 3 or 4 months sea time on Trillium, and that was and some basic, very basic training, and that was about all. And me, and there was just the three of us, and which was crazy, of course. But there was a fair amount of traffic back and forth. People going over to England for long courses that they couldn't get in Canada, and then going back as passengers to go back into the Canadian Navy, you know, to a ship. So we got as many of these passengers as we could that had a watchkeeping ticket, and so that we could operate and go back, you know, go back and forth.
Mm-hmm. So once you're on board here and ready to go, in your first crossing, aside from say the enemy, of course, what kind of adversity and problems did you face?
Well, the first crossing was supposed to be. Well, the ships were small, these corvettes, and they were rough. And I, for one, was always seasick.
Mm-hmm.
Never seasick in the merchant service because of the bigger ships, but these things would roll on wet grass, they used to say. And so our biggest enemy was the weather, the environment, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And our first trip was supposed to be to Iceland. And in fact, I think it was to Iceland. And what the arrangement, as I remember, was that the ships would be formed up in convoys, started out with an escort, left to make their own way across in as a group, and then picked up by a British escort about, I think, 20 west or something, you know, a good few hundred miles off the coast, and brought into the coast. And that was what the ship had been doing up until the time I joined her.
Okay.
And then they changed it that we would go a little further out, go to Iceland and fuel, and then come back and pick up another convoy that was going the other way, going back to
Canada?
Back to Britain. So, you know, we started in Britain. We were based in...
You're based in Britain.
Yeah, in Greenock, just outside of Glasgow.
Okay.
And that's where I joined the ship. And this Iceland run was very short-lived, really. I think we only did a couple of trips there. And then they shipped us right across to St. John's, Newfoundland.
Mm-hmm.
And based us there. And of course the corvette could in fact had the fuel and the endurance to go right across and back, you know.
How did you find the onboard equipment in those first few crossings to Iceland?
Pretty hard because we had nothing to compare it with. I'd never heard of ASDIC. It used to be called ASDIC, anti-submarine industrial something or other.
Yeah, I don't remember it.
Now called sonar.
Yes.
And it was terribly basic. The operator sat on a little chair better than the captain's chair on the bridge, and turned a little small steering wheel. And what he was doing was he was turning a transducer 5 degrees each time, and they'd ping out and it'd echo back, or at least if it hit anything, it would echo back and you'd know there was something there.
Mm-hmm.
But that's pretty basic, you know. We had earphones, not very comfortable earphones, and everything depended on one individual's acuity, really, I suppose, certainly their ability. I was made the AS control officer. I'd never seen or heard of a sonar.
Mm-hmm.
at this point, but you learn pretty quickly, you know, and the senior guy in the whole department was a petty officer.
So,
who had done quite a bit of training, or some training anyway, and he taught me all he knew in a week, you know, sort of stuff. But it was all manual, nothing automatic. He actually, when you turned this wheel, you were turning, in fact, a wheel into a gear and a gear into a long rod and.
Yeah.
With a transducer on the end outside the bottom of the ship.
Right. So that aside, how about your actual anti-submarine weapons on board at this point? What did you have?
Well, we had what we called throwers on each side of the ship, which could fire. The Yanks called them Y guns, I think. But they could throw a depth charge a fair way, and we had AS the charge rails dead astern, and so we used to use it in 10 charge patterns. You dropped, I think I've forgotten, the two off the stern, you'd fire the two after ones on the ship's side, four and two more, and anyway there were ten total spread out over a fair area.
Mm-hmm.
I would have thought the area of this city lot here,
right,
you know.
So
this ship going as fast as she
a few thousand square feet then anyway.
Yeah
okay.
And they had a fuse set in them. That was set either shallow or deep. You could set it at 50 feet or you could set it at 250 feet. And theoretically, they went off by pressure, you see, by
mm-hmm.
you know, water pressure, as the thing sank. The truth was, of course, that they had to be almost in the conning tower of a submarine before they went off, before they do any damage anyway. We didn't know that.
Right.
We thought that if we fired one anywhere within hundreds of yards, we'd kill people.
Right. So what measures measures were at your disposal to say avoid U-boats at this early stage? Just interception and or contact?
Well, they did... I think they did quite a bit through the way they diverted the ship's track across the ocean, because I think they knew more about where the German submarines were than the Germans thought they knew, and it turns out, of course, that they had the codes all broken pretty well.
Mm-hmm. How about you personally in those first days?
We got what used to be called a situation report, was transmitted by radio every night, which gave the approximate positions, best guess positions, of the German submarines, and rerouted the convoys if necessary. Or at least alerted us that there was one in the neighborhood or three in the neighborhood or something, you know. And we had quite good hydrophones up for obviously to pick up the echoes from the AS set itself, but they also worked. You know, we could hear torpedoes coming and. You hoped you heard them in time. That it was one thing about corvettes, they could spin around pretty quick.
You might be able to.
Well, yeah, quite a few people were, you know, combed the path of the incoming. torpedo.
Mm-hmm. Okay. If you were attacked or you found yourself under attack, was there necessarily any set reaction plan or course of action?
Oh yeah.
Can you tell me about that?
I can't really remember. But there were patterns for searches, depending on where, relatively speaking. If you heard a torpedo coming in from the starboard side and you were on the starboard corner of the convoy, you gave the alarm and went through a maneuver, which was, most of them were designed to light up the area with as much light as you could, so you could see periscopes and things, and then you could attack them. Most of the time, nobody. Well, I never saw a periscope the whole goddamn war. Pardon my French.
No problem.
But lots of people did, and there were lots of. Or the other thing was, if you saw a torpedo track coming, you could run down the track, and you had to make a guess as to where he was when he fired, mm-hmm. and where he was going. Now, you know, because
it's not going to sit still.
At 15 knots or 14 knots or something that a corvette would do, it takes a long time to get anywhere, you know.
Okay. So while you're in the Atlantic, I mean, there's U-boats to deal with. There's the weather. How did these things and other things affect your morale? Like, I mean, these obviously won't be so great, but what other things were detrimental, and what gave you guys what gave you a boost to keep you going too?
The spells in port helped a bit, but they were short. Refits, boiler clean, so many hours, after so many hours steaming, you had to get in and clean the boilers,
mm-hmm.
tubes and stuff, and that meant a slightly longer stay in harbor than you would normally get. Normally you'd get about 4 or 5 days maybe, and with a boiler clean, you had to go to Halifax from St. John's. And you got 10 days then, something like that. And you could get a little bit of repair work done, and you could see your wife, and if
mm-hmm.
you had a wife, and see your girlfriend, if you had a girlfriend.
Right.
And we had no movies or anything like that. What else did we do? I don't know. We had a broadcast system later on in some of the corvettes, so that they could play music and stuff, you know.
Right.
But that was later on.
Right. Okay. How did your equipment and slash weapons change over the course of your time?
Well.
And how did that change things for you?
I think the biggest single advance that we made was getting a gyro compass. When these ships were originally built, certainly Canadian corvettes, they were built with magnetic compasses. They didn't have gyro compasses, which were all, I think, built in Britain. And so this first corvette that I had, Trillium, she was an RN flower, you know, Royal Naval
yeah.
flower, and because she was, we got a lot more equipment than the Canadian pals in the next ship, which were RCN ships, you know, HMCS. But once you got a gyro compass, then you could get the next step up of the ASDIC set, and it was a lot more automatic. You, for instance, would do train around. You could set it to do 5 degree steps for 100 degrees or whatever, and it'd do it by itself. There was a good recorder which you used to fire your depth charges on. And then later on we got Hedgehog and toward, I guess must have been about 43 we got Hedgehog, 44. It took a long time after these were invented and approved and built. They had to be built, and then they had to be fitted. The ship had to be taken out of operations and fitted, or wait until a refit. So it took months and months to equip the whole group of us with all the. In fact, some of us never got all the top stuff, you know, new stuff. I was in 3 Corvettes, and we had certainly the Trillium had better radar when I left her in 1942 than the next ship I had, which I joined in 43 and didn't leave her till 44, and she never did get caught up in terms of the radar. Which was all brand new and tricky and broke down.
Yeah.
And but you know, every new thing that we got changed the tactics a little bit, changed the thinking a little bit, and there were a lot of bright guys doing a lot of bright thinking.
Yeah.
To use this stuff.
Can you elaborate or give me any examples on that? Or?
Well, one of the guys I think that's involved in this study you're going to do is I'll think of his name in a minute.
Sure. We can come back to that.
Just gone. He ended up an admiral. Well, Bob Whelan.
Oh yeah.
And he's a thinker, and he invented a couple of things, a couple of little plotting devices, and so on and so forth, based entirely on the new gear and using his nut, you know.
Mm-hmm. So how would you rate the efficiency and effectiveness of this new gear?
Well, as it came, it was good. What used to burn us up was it took so goddamn long for us to get it.
Yeah.
You've heard this story before, I'm quite sure.
A little bit, yeah.
If you've ever read Mark Milner and his stuff, and he's dead right. You know, we used to, as I say, I joined in my second Corvette, which is Kenogami, and it had an old Swick radar set that was just not worth the trouble to put it on the mast. We never used it, you know. And we used this, it was dangerous to put any kind of faith in it at all, because you never knew.
Yeah.
The Aztec set was all right, but it was very old, very basic, very.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
All right. I had command of what they called an increased endurance Corvette, which commissioned in 44, and finally the Canadian Navy had caught up to the RN. We had a good 271 radar, and we had a good ASIC set. You know, it was the current stuff. It wasn't hand-me-downs from the RN.
Yeah. I guess last of all, how can you take me through maybe a crossing or two, and just anything that might be of note to you or you might think of importance? Just generally, what would happen from one side to the other?
Well, we had a couple of bad crossings or good ones, as the case may be. I remember once leaving in Kenogami in 43, I guess, sometime in 43. I was the first attendant by then, not the navigator. And we'd come out of Northern Ireland and we're on our way to pick up the convoy, which is slowly forming, you know, as people were trickling along the coast and so on. And it had been blowing pretty hard, and the worst part of the gale was over. We were about 4 days out, I would think, and we had just collected the convoy and got it going. We're settling down. Anyway, we got hit by what you might call a rogue wave. Everything was relatively quiet, and then this one big wave came up and smashed the front end of the wheelhouse completely, broke all the windows and flooded the place. And this is where the helmsman stood and all the rest of it. And we rode off the magnetic compass, which is the only compass we had. And there we were, ruined, smashed up the one whaler we had, small boat we had, lifeboat. And to cut a long story short, we were, I think it took 3 days for us to get back to Ireland. We had to get one of the boat compasses. We had a spare boat compass, which is a little thing about this big. Rig it up, affix a steering gear, rig it up so that the helmsman could see it, and then do some fancy navigation to find out where the hell we were. And it took us 3.5-4 days to get back to Ireland. They had to really completely rebuild the front end of the bridge altogether.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was quite an effort on our part to get back without any having to yell for help or anything.
Mm-hmm. Anything.
And what else? I think one of the things that I'd like to get off my chest is there's been a lot to say about the relative merits and the efficiency of the Canadian Navy vis-a-vis the Royal Navy. And not too many people I think appreciate the fact that almost all the close escort work, the little corvettes that hung around the convoy and stayed with them and escorted them the whole way over, they were all Canadian, or most of them were Canadian, from about 40, certainly from 42 on. And when you got a submarine contact, or what you thought was a submarine contact, you couldn't ever stay with it. You had to go back to the convoy. Because if you ever got too far behind the convoy, you'd never catch them again. When they had a corvette that could only do, you know, 14 knots maybe in flat calm. So that, but on the other hand, the guys that were sinking submarines were people in the so-called hunting groups who were sent specifically to areas where they knew there were submarines and told us bloody well stay there and kill them, you know.
Yeah.
And so they had no pressure to move on, if you see what I mean. So
yeah.
Guys like the so-called aces of the war, that I'm not taking away from them. They were clever, brave, good guys, but they did have better opportunities than we did, I think.
Right. You were just...
Yeah.
You were tied up.
Yeah, well, you had a mission. The mission
mm-hmm.
was to get safe and timely arrival of the ships. you know, at their destination.
Yeah.
And everything, you know, we had to leave survivors paddling around in the water. And that hurts.
Mm-hmm.
That really hurts.
Yeah.
When you have to say slow ahead or half ahead, both, and get the hell out of there. Knowing that these guys are going to die. Yeah. So.
Anything else you'd like to add just about
that? No, the only entertaining thing that we
sure.
that I could think of was, well, no, entertaining is not the right word, but one of the last crossings I did in my own command in Guelph was we escorted a submarine who was from Portsmouth to up the Delaware River, Philadelphia. He was going over for refit under the Lend-Lease thing. He'd just come back from the Far East or Mediterranean or somewhere. And I don't know why they picked me, but we went down to Portsmouth and picked this guy up, and we convoyed him or protected him all the way across the North Atlantic. Did a pretty good fast trip because he didn't have to worry about slow merchant ships. And that was a good fast passage, and new, you know, unusual.
Mm-hmm.
He daren't let a submarine go over by himself in case he got caught by the wrong people, like his own, you know.
Yeah.
So, and then we got to Philadelphia, had a boiler clean down there, which is all very clever, cleverly organized.
Good. Good. Anything at all you'd like to add just about the Atlantic and anything about anti-submarine warfare and whatnot?
Yeah.
Because that's the topic at large here.
Yeah. I don't... It's all thankfully fading into the background now. I had a hard time when I was writing my little book, too, about trying to, without going into 100 pages of garbage, to try and condense. We were frightened, all of us, whether we admitted it or not, and we were uncomfortable, but everybody was, so what the hell, what's the point? Nobody was getting excited about it. I didn't personally, but we had some occasions when people fell and damaged them, you know, hurt themselves, had to have emergency runs ashore. You have to remember that there were no helicopters around in those days, few airplanes. Once we got the airplanes all the way across, it made a great deal of difference.
Yeah.
Great deal of difference. Much more. I was very slow to I personally was very slow to appreciate. You know, I knew what was happening, but I didn't. It took me a long time really to really appreciate the consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And it was much safer for us guys, I think.
Right. Okay.
But thank God I don't have to do it again.
Yeah. All right. Well, if that's it, then
well,
I guess we're done. Thanks very much.
Well, you're very welcome.